my city, flickering dirty neon over alleys mean and dirty streets, while my neighborhood is torn down around me. Too many people on
from a nightclub
Sunday
at the end
streets.
Of the world. This is Michael C. Rupert, Tracker of Truth, coming to you tonight, the 25th of August in the year 2013. What a show tonight. It's going to be a big one. As I'm speaking now, I'm just advised that Helen Callicott is standing by as we start this show. I've got a couple of quick notes up here at the beginning before we bring her on for this show. We're going without commercial interruption tonight. Too many things to talk about. Well, not too many, but two big things to talk about, I guess. And we will get to that as soon as we can. There were two very, very important articles, two of the finest pieces of writing that I have read in ages this week. They're posted on my Facebook page. And they all have to do with the environment, the milieu in which we are living right now, which is one where near-term human extinction is actually sinking in on many levels to human consciousness. And there are some, these were just some perfect articles to have appeared this week. One is called Coping Skills, written by Doug Fashing. It appeared at Nature Bats Last. That's Guy McPherson's website, guymcpherson.com. Coping Skills. It is an amazing, juicy, wonderful read through coming to a healthy, if you will, perception and stance vis-a-vis the life-threatening crises which are now staring all 7 billion of us collectively in the face. And another was a piece by my dear friend Carolyn Baker, who fills in for me on this show, on her website, CarolynBaker.net. The title was Fukushima Climate Change Near-Term Extinction, Resignation versus Surrender. A beautiful, beautiful spiritual piece. Both of these were. And they are extremely relevant to what we're going to talk about tonight. George Orwell wrote, freedom is the freedom to say that 2 + 2 = 4. Once that is granted, all else follows. And my experience over a long 30-year career has been not in getting people to agree that 2 + 2 = 4, but getting them to agree that that was what was being presented to them as a real-life equation. But that is truly the doorway to freedom. Freedom of the consciousness, and it's not so much staying alive these days, guys. You know, it's staying human that's what's important. That's going to become more and more relevant. In the 3 years that I've been with you doing the Lifeboat Hour, we've been privileged to have many amazing guests on the show. Graham Hancock, Guy McPherson, Derek Jensen, the wonderful Carolyn Baker, Michelle Chosudowski, who is a friend and colleague of both myself and Helen Callicott. It's a long list we've had here, but I'll bet that every one of them is listening to this show tonight. I want to lay a couple things out just very quickly before I introduce her, and I want us all to try to get our heads around that. First of all, I've read just about every story out there, and I do have a record over a fairly long career of getting things right. My first awareness concern tonight is that of all the threats facing the world right now, even as the Western powers have announced that they are getting ready to attack Syria, which will immediately invoke Iranian and Chinese response, okay, that's really bad. The climate collapse with which we are so familiar, thanks to Guy McPherson and so many others, is running apace. We could do a whole show tonight on horrendous weather events happening around the world. I am not asking you to lay them aside. I am asking you to remember that they are part of the wallpaper and the ambiance with which we do this show tonight. But of all of the crises confronting the human race right now, the nuclear crisis at Fukushima is, in my opinion, and we will find out from our guest, by far the most dangerous, and I will go one step beyond that and say clearly that even though the amounts and concentrations of radiation in the water being flooded out from Fukushima Daiichi into the Pacific Ocean, and which have been for 2.5 years, are very, very serious. We've just posted a story on Facebook tonight showing that all of radioactive tuna being caught off the California coast, all of the bluefin tuna are radioactive. They are tripping Geiger counters now. They concentrate the radiation. That's all very bad. But it's a fact of life in the nuclear world that a release into water is considered a measure of control as opposed to an atmospheric release. And I will ask Helen here shortly, but I have come to the conclusion that it's about a 90 to 100% certainty that one of the fuel pools at Fukushima Daiichi is going to collapse, and I think that that conclusion has already been reached. Nothing compares to an atmospheric release, especially when it would be an uncontrolled release of fissionable material for Building 4 alone, the equivalent of 14,000 Hiroshima bombs in terms of the cesium that would be released. That being a given, there's a second follow-up point that I will bring up, and we will consult on this, which has to do with what would happen if there wasn't, if one of the fuel pools went. And those consequences remind me of great movies like On the Beach, 1959 Stanley Kramer with Gregory Peck, Ava Gardner, Fred Astaire, Tony Perkins, and Failsafe, with which I'm sure Helen Callicott is familiar. As I bring her in tonight, I am sitting with enormous gratitude. I am a former cop, and I have personally have been shot. I've had the second and third degree burns. I've been in a lot of ERs, but more than that, I've worked with physicians in life-threatening situations, with gunshot victims, stabbing victims, traffic accident victims, and I've worked with paramedics and guys who are medics in Vietnam. There are a certain set of things that you do when you come across a dying person or someone who is severely injured, and you do them in a priority, because if you don't take care of the most important item first, none of the others, the rest become absolutely academic. And for her clarity, Helen Caldicott, who is now standing by on the phone, she was born in Melbourne, Australia in 1938. Dr. Caldicott received her medical degree from the University of Adelaide Medical School in 1961. She founded the Cystic Fibrosis Clinic at the Adelaide Children's Hospital in 1975 and subsequently was an instructor in pediatrics at the Harvard Medical School and on the staff of Children's Hospital Medical Center, Boston, Mass. Until 80, when she resigned to work full-time on the prevention of nuclear war. Sounds like Guy McPherson and me. We have as a family here, and I'm proud to be in his company. While living in the States from 77 to 86, she co-founded Physicians for Social Responsibility, an organization of 23,000 doctors committed to educating their colleagues about the dangers of nuclear power, nuclear weapons, and nuclear war. On trips abroad, she helped start similar medical organizations in other countries, the international umbrella group International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1985. She also founded the Women's Action for Nuclear Disarmament, WAND, in the U.S. in 1980. Dr. Callicott has received prizes and awards all over the place. She's 21 honorary degrees. She's written 7 books. She is ubiquitous, and she is... we are so grateful for her longevity and her energy. She's been in a number of video clips that we have posted on my Facebook page. I've seen her with our mutual friend, Michelle Chelsadowski. And she's out there, and she's tireless, and she's nonstop. And she has been an inspiration to so many of us for so long. I will add, as I welcome her to the lifeboat hour, that I kind of suspect that if the human race perishes, the cause of death might be listed as acute and aggressive cognitive dissonance. None would have been as bad, perhaps, as the cognitive dissonance I would have had she actually been awarded the Nobel Peace Prize herself, because that's a prize that's also been given to Henry Kissinger and Barack Obama. But at any rate, we are all blessed to have you with us, Dr. Helen Caldicott, from Down Under in Australia. Welcome to the Lifeboat Hour.
Thank you very much.
I started off by laying out some conclusions that I had reached, and I can go back to a tremendous Russia Today article that appeared last week and that we talked about on last week's show, in which the challenges confronting TEPCO or whoever attempts it to remove the spent fuel rods from Building 4 were laid out. Now, the cranes which used to do that and the computers which used to judge to control the distances between the rods, which have been partially, as I understand, burned already, their zirconium cladding is gone. Those operations now will have to be performed by human beings operating a crane which is not there yet. and the rods cannot come in contact with each other, which would result in an uncontrolled fission reaction. The challenges are enormous for that. So I would start by asking you a two-part question. Number one, it's my take that everybody in the world understands that those rods have to come out because building four certainly and building three are going to come down very soon anyway. They're being undermined. And assuming the urgency of that, what would be the consequences of an open-air fission reaction?
Well, it's quite complex, really. Several things have occurred recently. It seems like the four reactor buildings, 1, 2, 3, and 4, are now sort of standing on liquefied mud, because what happened, and I read this in the Wall Street Journal recently, was there was a river that ran through the area on which Fukushima was built.
Yes.
So they diverted the river to build the reactors. Well, you can't divert rivers because they tend to go back to their natural course. So there's an enormous amount of water moving down from the mountains through that, I suppose, underground river now, underneath the reactors. And because we think that one or several of those three molten cores, each weighing 100 tons and each being incredibly radioactive, may have melted their way through the floor of the containment, which is 6 inches of concrete and steel, into the earth, means that the water submerging these cores, if it is becoming extraordinarily radioactive.
Mm-hmm.
And so the solidity of the ground on which these four reactors were built is losing ground. Well, that's a silly thing to say, but it's not stable anymore. That's what they're saying.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, if there's another earthquake, and there are earthquakes there all the time, little ones, but if there's another one greater than 7, it is fairly sure, they say, that buildings 4 could collapse because it was severely damaged and the walls buckled during the first earthquake.
Right.
And on top of building 4, as you said, is this cooling pool that stands 100 feet above the ground, containing over 100 tons of extraordinarily radioactive material, which was removed just before the earthquake occurred from the reactor. So it's fresh fuel virtually. It's cooled down a little, that's all. And if that fell to the ground, as you said, well, it would release 10 times more cesium than was released at Chernobyl, and a huge amount of radioactivity, because the fuel rods would burn, the zirconium cladding of the fuel rods would burn if exposed to air, because it would lose its cooling water and it would be exposed to air. They're talking about having to evacuate 35 million people from Tokyo, and that's now becoming more of a discourse within Japan,
mm-hmm.
not so much internationally. Now, the building is very damaged, as I said, so they've constructed another steel sort of armament around that building so that they can hoist a huge crane weighing, I don't know, a huge amount, to the top of that new building to lift the rods out from the spent fuel pool. However, as you pointed out, well, we don't know. The rods may be bent.
Mm.
It may be very difficult to get them out. No human can go near them, so it has to all to be done by remote control. And as you pointed out, normally the cranes to lift the spent fuel rods out of the pool are controlled, the whole thing's controlled by computer, and it's very, very carefully measured and calculated. You can't do it that this time. And as you pointed out, if there is a sort of collusion of the fuel rods and they get together, a critical mass could occur. Now, it might only be between a couple of the rods, it may be between several hundred. Who knows? It's absolutely unknown what could happen.
Mm-hmm.
But if you reach critical mass, of course, the thing starts fissioning like in a normal nuclear reactor or an atomic bomb. There won't be an explosion, but large amounts of gamma rays are produced, which is like X-rays and lots of fission products like cesium and strontium and radioactive iodine and the like, and that means that the workers would have to evacuate. Therefore,
yes.
the whole thing would have to be left. Now, if that happened too, if it was bad enough, the workers in the other three reactors who are trying to control the whole situation would have to also evacuate. And if that happened, other fuel pools could get into trouble because the cooling water wouldn't be continuously circulated. And just to the south of Fukushima Daiichi is Fukushima Daini, several, I don't know, about 10 or 15 kilometers away.
Is that and 4 or 6 reactors?
I think it's 4.
Okay.
And we were just lucky that they didn't melt down during the original earthquake, but there's a scenario that's been painted that workers, if it was severe enough at Fukushima Daiichi with all these abnormalities I'm talking about, then Fukushima Daini might have to be evacuated, and
yes,
it would be sort of a cascade of events.
I have looked at a map, the distribution of reactors throughout Japan. There are some 84 or something like that, if you count commercial and research reactors in Japan, roughly evenly distributed between northern and southern Japan. But we have seen, and I believe it was either Chris Busby or Arne Gunderson or somebody said that, you know, if there is an open-air out-of-control reaction, one of the fuel pools goes completely, northern Japan might become uninhabitable. Does it then follow ipso facto that it would be impossible to maintain in a cascading effect or domino-like effect the remainder of the reactors?
Well, no, because the other reactors are all shut down. They're not fissioning.
Okay.
They have to be kept cool continuously by about 1 million gallons a minute being circulated through the reactor cores. There are two reactors operating at Oi, which they've just found has an active earthquake running between the two reactors. They will be shut down shortly for maintenance, and they may not reopen. In fact, what is happening in Fukushima now is so severe and so out of control that I doubt if Abe, the new Prime Minister, will be able to open any of the reactors. But I don't think we would need acutely to worry about the other reactors. Rather, we'd have to worry about the population. And already in the Fukushima prefecture, 44 children under the age of 18 have been diagnosed with thyroid cancer. Now, that is extraordinary because the incidence of thyroid cancer in children under the age of 15, I think, is 1 in 1 million.
Oh.
So we are seeing already the tip of the iceberg, which means the iceberg is going to be, I think, thousands and thousands of cases of cancer occurring over time.
Now,
it takes a long time to get cancer.
There is a distinct difference between release of radiation into a body of water and the dosages of radiation that would be emitted as a result of an open-air chain reaction, which I believe would be much, much higher. That's a lot of people here on Facebook, a lot of people in the States, Northern Hemisphere, of course, extremely concerned about the time involved. And of course, we already know that Fukushima radiation has reached the California coast with the bluefin tuna and other evidence. But there is concern, and it's my understanding, that an atmospheric release would result in the presence of large quantities of radiation over the northern hemisphere in a matter of days rather than weeks or months. Is that correct?
Yeah, the winds move pretty fast. Some days after the first accident 2.5 years ago, the ambient levels of radiation over Seattle went up 40,000 times above normal. Americium, which is a very nasty carcinogenic agent, was found in Boston, and all over America there were fallouts of various isotopes. And within days, the whole thing circled the globe, and it was measured in Sweden, the radiation, etc. But if, you know, Building 4 did collapse and the cooling pool did burn, it would be a catastrophe for the Northern Hemisphere. And you need to know that the two air masses at the equator do not mix. So we in the southern hemisphere would not be affected by the atmospheric fallout. However, the ocean, the Pacific Ocean, that's our ocean too. In fact, I live on the Pacific Ocean, and fish can swim everywhere. Now, when you say it's more dangerous for atmospheric radiation than radiation in water, that's not actually true
okay.
in the long term. because the isotopes, the elements, and there are about 100 long-lived isotopes, all sorts of elements, radioactive silver, radioactive gold, cesium, strontium, iron, you name it, get into the water, and what happens in the life cycle is that the algae concentrate these elements maybe, well, orders of magnitude, 10 to hundreds of times. Then the crustaceans eat the algae, same thing happens. The next thing, the little fish eat the crustaceans, same thing. Big fish eat the little fish. That's why tuna can be very radioactive, and why it's not good to eat, you know, big fish, because they tend to concentrate radioactive elements most highly. So, and the seaweed's concentrating it too. And these fish can swim, of course, thousands of miles, as the tuna have, and also down to Australia. The currents from Fukushima tend to go straight across the Pacific, over to the west coast, and also up around the top of the northern part of the Pacific, and then down past the west coast. Mm-hmm. As more and more radiation is excreted into the ocean by this out-of-control situation, totally out of control, there will be more and more radioactive fish. So to say that, yeah, the water dilutes the concentration actually is not true. The solution to pollution by dilution of radiation is fallacious, because you can't dilute it because it reconcentrates back in the food chain. The same on the land, of course, in the rice and the milk and the meat and the whole thing.
Okay, we're about 20 minutes in now, and there's a lot to talk about. But I can almost hear all of my followers begging to ask one question. If there were, let's say, I would call it a worst case, but I think it's a very likely case scenario. If Building 4 did collapse and those rods went to open air, what would your advice be? What would you recommend? What would you want the people of the world to understand about the significance of that?
Oh, well, that's hard for me to say. I've got grandchildren in Boston who I adore, and I told my son I'm going to fly them down to Australia, and he said, "But Mum, I'll be a refugee." And I said, "Yeah, but you've got two little children. Look, what do you do for millions and billions of people who live in the Northern Hemisphere? There's not much you can actually do."
It does kind of remind you of the movie On the Beach, doesn't it?
Yes, it does, and that's the thing that started me off on my anti-nuclear career, when I read that book when I was about 15 and lived in Melbourne, Australia, which is, you know, where the book was set. And
sure.
At the end of the book, everyone was dead in the world.
Yes, and that is not a scenario which is out of the question at the moment, especially with 400...
Well, no, this won't kill everyone in the world. That's not true. It will definitely raise the incidence of cancer and other diseases like diabetes and etc., but only a nuclear war between Russia and America could induce nuclear winter and the end of life on Earth. And that could happen tonight, because the weapons are still on hair trigger alert. Nothing's changed since the Cold War ended.
Given the fact that we know of so many reactors around the world, there are many GE Mark 1s all over the U.S., all around the world, and we have seen in the wake of economic collapse and so forth that there's a horrendous lack of maintenance being paid to them. We have there's a long list of nuclear power plants in the United States, Indian Point, I mean, San Onofre. There's a long list of ones that are teetering for lack of maintenance. And one of the questions that I have raised as a result of my work around collapse is, and economic collapse, resources, energy available, money is not power, is that it is and should be an absolute imperative to safely shut down, which is a long process, all of these reactors while we still have the ability.
Well, you're right. I've been working with the people at Pilgrim, which is in Plymouth at the entrance of Cape Cod, where hundreds of thousands of people holiday during the summer. And Pilgrim is very dangerous. What's more, it's got a huge amount of spent fuel on its roof, like the G Mark I reactors in Fukushima. And that's terribly dangerous. And as power plants age, like Vermont Yankee, Indian Point, Pilgrim, San Onofre, Diablo Canyon, they're like, nuclear power plants can be compared to human beings. When you're born, in the first few years of life, you're vulnerable to getting infections and all sorts of other nasty diseases, then during sort of midlife you settle down and you're relatively stable health-wise, mostly.
Yes.
Then as you start to get older, like me, your parts start getting eroded and becoming brittle, and I've got an abnormality in my aorta, for instance. And that same thing happens to nuclear reactors, because as they're exposed to more and more neutron radiation, the metal in the pipes becomes embrittled and is likely to crack and break. Meanwhile, because the utilities make about $1 million a day selling electricity and they have no cost, they didn't build the reactor, I mean, everything was subsidized and the insurance and the like, they are extending the lives of the reactors another 20 years when they were only designed to operate for 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
What more, they're pushing up the power from 3% enriched uranium to, I think, 4.5, and the reactors are literally shaking themselves to bits. It's only so they can make money, and I think because the issue is so complex, people really need to understand what is going on in their backyards.
Mm. Which you know, a hallmark of my work and my career, my two books, which where I have distilled this down into, which is, until you change the way money works, you change nothing, because we live in an infinite growth paradigm on a finite planet, and the monetary paradigm demands continued growth, productivity, and industrial civilization does not function without electricity. Hell of a way to boil water.
But I commissioned a report in 2007, I think, by a wonderful physicist called Arjun Makajani, called Carbon-Free, Nuclear-Free. And in fact, the truth is, by now, America could be carbon-free, nuclear-free by 2030 if, in fact, the government got off its backside and covered every single building and every single house and every single parking lot with solar panels. So everyone drove solar-powered cars. All electricity was generated by solar and wind. There's three times more electricity. There's enough wind west of the Mississippi to supply three times the amount of electricity America currently uses, and Americans waste 28% of their electricity. So it's easily done. It would increase the GDP and increase employment. All we need is those politicians to get out of the pockets of the corporations and do the right thing for us.
Indeed.
After all, we elected them.
There's a slight problem with, you'd have to have battery storage for all that electricity, because the winds don't always blow and the sun doesn't always shine at peak demand.
No, but what you do is you have a smart grid, and when the winds aren't blowing, there are solar thermal plants now where you can store the heat overnight and for a long time. That's not true. It's now very easy to compatibly mix a heterogeneous collection of renewable energy production. So actually, that's not true. I would advise you to download Carbon-Free, Nuclear-Free from Amazon and read it. It's quite complex, but it's an excellent study. And the state of Utah is using it. The state of Texas, Nancy Pelosi's been reading it. It really is the roadmap for the future and to survival.
Well, thank you for giving me information I didn't have. I'm always eager to learn, especially when it proves my darkest conclusions wrong. We're at the bottom of the hour, and one of the things we've done, you know, Helen, this is a show we call The Nightclub at the End of the World. I'm a singer-songwriter, but I have learned over my long career that unless you mix in music, art, and love with the work that you do, one loses balance. But there are a great many people who have deep affection for you and your long dedication. So I asked you to pick a piece of music that we would play tonight that would invite us into your heart space. And we're getting ready to roll that. We're at the bottom of the hour. This is Michael C. Rupert on Tracker of Truth on the Lifeboat Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. We're going to roll without a commercial break. But, Helen, you have selected a piece by Brahms, and I'd like you to set it up for us. I've listened to it. It is extremely powerful. I'm warning everybody, get your hankies ready. This is a great piece of music. This is the Alto
Rhapsody, sung by Kathleen Ferrier.
Is it from an opera?
No. It's just a single piece of music Brahms wrote, but it really does twang my heartstrings and makes me weep, and that's what I want played at my funeral.
Well, you know, it is good that we all connect in that space, because it helps to drive home the fact that these situations we are facing now, these questions and issues that we answer as human beings, are extremely important, because that's what's on the line. So let's roll this piece now, and then when we come back, we will finish the show with the wonderful Helen Caldicott. Let's hear Clemens Krauss conduct the London Philharmonic Orchestra playing the Alto Rhapsody Opus 53 by Johannes Brahms.
Oh,
apologize for my breathing over that amazing performance. That was a very powerful piece of music. Thank you, Helen Caldicott, for bringing that to us tonight. We're back on the Lifeboat Hour here on the Progressive Radio Network, continuing with our discussion about radiation and the issues surrounding Fukushima. I want to go back to a point that we reached earlier, which seemed pretty clear, that if there is an open-air combustion, if one of the buildings falls, they're talking about the mandatory, and I've seen this in print in several places, 35 million people from the greater Tokyo region. I've never heard of anything like that ever being attempted before, or the effects of that upon Japan as a whole. Do you think that's feasible to do?
No. No, it's not. I mean, when you look at the evacuation plans of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in America, they say you have to evacuate from a 10-mile radius around the reactor, which is ridiculous. But can you imagine if Indian Point melted down 35 miles from Manhattan?
Yes.
Westchester County, all the roads would be clogged. No one could get to pick up their children from school. No one could get to their spouses. And as the radiation passed over New York, all the tunnels would be clogged, the bridges would be clogged. I mean, it's impossible, and they couldn't possibly evacuate. And by the time they tried to get them out, the radioactive cloud would have blown over and dropped on Tokyo anyway, and probably would continue for days, like Chernobyl burnt for 10 days. Scattering radiation across Europe.
Now, you are a physician. Would this kind of deposition of radioactive material in a short period of time show us what we already know to be developing cancers rapidly, or would we see much more rapid onset of symptoms as akin to stuff that I talked about with my family as a kid, you know, where your hair starts falling out immediately, hemorrhaging, AIDS-like symptoms? What would likely be the effect of that?
Well, it depends on the dose you get. If you're enveloped in a cloud of very radioactive gases and elements, and there's a huge amount of gamma radiation being emitted from the elements, like X-rays, you can develop acute radiation sickness, which is, within days, your hair starts... It kills the rapidly dividing cells of the body, so the hair drops out. You develop severe nausea, vomiting and bloody diarrhea, and you would bleed because the platelets which form clotting would be killed. And that's how people died in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It was a new disease never before recorded in the medical records. Now, if you are further away and the rain comes down with the fallout from the stratosphere or the troposphere, You will probably taste, people enveloped in clouds of radioactive gases taste a funny metallic taste in their mouth. Mm-hmm. And that was recorded at Chernobyl and Three Mile Island and at Fukushima. The people will be subject to infections in the next few weeks to months because radiation affects the immune mechanism and the white blood cells, so they can't fight infection, and that's a very important thing to know. And there were many infections after Fukushima originally happened, particularly among the children. Children are 10 to 20 times more sensitive to radiation than adults. In other words, they get cancers much earlier, which is why they're looking at the children in Fukushima, just looking at their thyroids. But the International Atomic Energy Agency only recognizes thyroid cancer as a result of radiation, but all cancers can be caused by radiation, and all cancers have different incubation times. Leukemia is about 5 years, and leukemia is cancer of the white blood cells, 5 to 10 years, and then solid cancers after Hiroshima and Nagasaki started appearing 15 years later. We're still seeing new cancers appearing in those survivors, like renal cancers, multiple myeloma. So in other words, each cancer has a different incubation time. Like a cold has 2 days. If you're sneezed on in 2 days, you're sneezing. Measles, mumps, whooping cough, it's 3 weeks. But cancer is a long, long latent period, and it's silent and cryptogenic. And when the cancer arises, you don't know what's caused it. It doesn't wear a little sign saying what caused the cancer. And you can't taste smell or see radiation in the food. You don't say, I can taste the cesium in this fish. So it's an invisible killer, invisible. That already, according to the New York Academy of Sciences in a report they produced on Chernobyl, over a million people have now died some 27 years post-Chernobyl. 40% of the European landmass is radioactive, and the radiation concentrates in the food. So I don't buy European food, and I will not buy any Japanese food at all, and nobody should.
Would you eat sushi in California?
You're importing Japanese food, right?
Would you eat sushi in California now?
Well, I would want the EPA to be testing the fish, and that's what people are starting to call for now. The EPA is not testing any fish on the West Coast, and they must, absolutely. And they must have air monitors to test radiation coming from Fukushima should there be another catastrophic, release of radiation. I will say, too, that Building 3 is very, very shaky as well, very fragile, and that's very dangerous. In fact, I think the radiation in Building 3 or 2 is so profound that no one can go into the building because they'd die, they'd get a dose of radiation that would kill them from acute radiation illness within a couple of weeks.
I have read that the radiation is so intense that it disables robots that even try to get too close to it, which is very not encouraging. There was a breaking story tonight on Bloomberg just about an hour before the show or so, 2 hours, that Russia has again offered to help TEPCO. Apparently, after TEPCO has issued now openly, finally too late, a call for help, admitting they are overwhelmed. I believe TEPCO to be overwhelmed, the Japanese government to be overwhelmed. What, if anything, can Russia do? What, if anything, could the world do?
I'd love to have a good question.
If all 7 billion of us turned our attention to this right now, what could be done?
Yeah. Well, first of all, TEPCO... they're only operators. They're not nuclear engineers. So they just sort of press buttons and things in reactors. One. Two, they've now been nationalized and they don't have enough money. They're trying to save money. They're trying to export reactors around the world, trying to open all the other reactors. They're practicing psychic numbing. Number three, the government really is TEPCO. They call it the nuclear village. Number four, the Japanese are very proud. And they don't want anyone else in to help or see the abnormalities they've created. Number five, this is a global problem. And the whole world, your nuclear engineers, the NRC, the Russians, the European community, Canada, which has great expertise in this area, needs to get in there immediately with building materials, with the expertise. It's a matter, like the Earth is in the intensive care unit, and we must, there's no time to waste, absolutely no time. And the time is being wasted, and I think partly the reason is that Cameco in Canada, your nuclear industries in America, they want to ignore the problem because they want to continue with this madness of nuclear power and weapons, because they're both related. And so they too are practicing psychic numbing. But I think it's gradually coming into the consciousness of the world that, my God, have we left it too late? And we must now immediately, the United Nations should be organizing the whole thing. Obviously, this is an acute radiological atomic emergency.
Does it not follow then that assuming, knock wood, touch wood, that somehow we managed to get Fukushima under control to a point of stability, which of course is debatable about Chernobyl, but just to get it to some point of stability, doesn't it follow that all 7 billion of us should have an immediate priority to safely shut down every reactor on the planet as quickly as possible?
Absolutely correct. Every reactor should be shut down tomorrow, and every coal fire plant should be shut down tomorrow, because we're threatened from three things, really. The ever-present risk of nuclear war, which could happen tonight by computer error. Mm-hmm. 1,000 people are hacking into the Pentagon every day. It could number one, nuclear war. Number two, nuclear power plants. Even if none of them melt down or have accidents like this, the amount of radioactive waste that has accrued, 70,000 tons in America, it must be isolated from the ecosphere for a million years, according to the EPA. You can't do that. No container lasts longer than 100 years, if not less. And the radioactive waste will leak into our water supplies throughout the world, in Russia, in France, in Europe, in America, in Canada, all over the place.
We already have that happening at Hanford, yes.
Yeah, that's right, and Savannah River concentrate in the food chain. You can imagine generations hence waking up in the morning. The breast milk is already radioactive. The babies are being born deformed, and I could talk about that at length, the deformed babies being born near Chernobyl. Extraordinary.
Yes.
The baby's already getting or having genetic disease, and there are now 6,000 genetic diseases, all of which will be increased by radiation, like diabetes, cystic fibrosis, and the like. Children getting cancer at the age of 6 instead of 60 because they're exposed to radiation in utero and in their breast milk and their food. That's the legacy. That's the legacy that the nuclear physicists have left our descendants. That's what they're going to inherit. And, you know, the men in the Manhattan Project, Oppenheimer et al., they knew at the time what this meant. They knew. And when Oppenheimer watched the first bomb explode, Trinity, he said, for the first time, physicists have known sin, and they've been sinning ever since.
That's extremely well put. I remember his quote, "I have become the destroyer of worlds," from the Bhagavad Gita.
That's right. Death, the destroyer of worlds. He knew.
Well, everybody knew, but yet we seem to have been stuck in this insane mandate for infinite growth. In the midst of all this now, a great friend and colleague of mine, Guy McPherson, professor emeritus from University of Arizona, you know, has been doing his own work, but he has amalgamated the work, which now identify 19 positive feedback loops that have been triggered. It was only 10 a few months ago. The global warming telling us that a 3-degree centigrade increase in global temperature is assured by 2030, which mathematically, that's 20-some peer-reviewed studies, that human extinction is likely by that time in the northern hemisphere, and probably not too much longer thereafter because the plants and species cannot adapt.
They can't migrate fast enough.
This does seem to be a crisis, as Graham Hancock, who I deeply admire and had as a guest on the show, a crisis of consciousness more than anything else. Because even as you say, and I'm eager to learn about what you revealed about the possibility of, I am extremely skeptical after a long career, as you must be as well, of us achieving the state of consciousness to agree to make those necessary changes. That seems to be the fundamental battle, right? How do you people to convince them to take these actions?
It's an excellent question. Well, you know, if I have an audience of 5,000 people, and I'm talking about, global warming and nuclear power and war, I first of all establish my credibility by giving them lots and lots and lots and lots of facts. And you can see them kind of settle down and think that, oh, she's credible. She knows what she's talking about. And then I go for their souls. And I start talking about what do they value? How precious is their own life? How much do they love their children? Why make sure the children clean their teeth and have a good education when in fact they have no future? Mm-hmm. And usually in an evening I can change the perspective of most of those people, and they come back years later and tell me that I did. But it has to be done on a global scale, and it has to be done through the media. It is through the media is determining the fate of the earth. And as President Jefferson said, an informed democracy will behave in a responsible fashion. And that's the only way you can really teach 270 million people in America or throughout the world. And therefore, well, each one of us, too, can be as powerful as the most powerful person who ever lived. I mean, I led the movement. I was an alien, a woman, a young woman, led the movement against nuclear weapons from 78 to 85 when I first started talking. Everyone said it's better to be dead than red, and I thought, this is psychotic. So we got together doctors who started explaining the medical effects of nuclear war, and the press said, what are doctors talking about this for? This is political. And we said, no, it's not, it's medical. And we got all over the television, and at the end of 5 years, 80% of Americans were opposed to nuclear war, including the Catholic Church, Methodist Church, the Mormons, the Southern Baptists, and we got a million people in Central Park. You know, each person can be incredibly powerful if they tap in to the purity of their soul with which they were born. And I guess I would say that, having delivered many babies myself, that the purity of a baby is just extraordinary. I mean, it really makes you weep. And then people get into school and into corporations, and that they lead sometimes quite wicked lives, you know, mm-hmm. in the terms we're discussing. And when they're on their deathbed, often these men will recant and tell me all the awful things they've done. Of course, it's too late, but at that time when their children are dying or they're dying, the purity of that soul opens up again. Therefore, it's always there. That is what gives me hope and keeps me going, because I know it's possible.
All right. That's a perfect setup. We're down to the last 7 or 8 minutes of the show. We're going to come back and finish with you, but I picked a song to contribute to this heart space that we're both sharing tonight. I'm going to roll this real quick, and then we'll come back and let Dr. Helen Caldicott have the last words with us. But she just set up this song perfectly. Let's roll a song called Calling All Angels by Jane Sibbery and Katie Lang.
Santa Maria, Santa Teresa, Santa Anna, Santa Susanna, Santa Cecilia, Santa Cordelia, Santa Domenica, Mary Angelica, Frater of Ashes, Frater Pietro, Julianus, Petronella, Santa, Santos, Mirasa, Madalia, and all of the rest.
The beauty of
amazing Jane Sibbery and Katie Lang, two absolute divas, calling all angels. We are down to the last 2 minutes of the show, Helen Caldicott. We've covered a lot of ground, and I've also deliberately opened up a lot of different spaces, so there's a lot of energies flowing around. If you have 2 minutes to tell all of those who are listening, the many tens of thousands listening tonight, what you would like them to know and what you think is important tonight.
Well, first of all, you all must become extremely well-informed. Go to my website, HelenCaldicottFoundation.org. There's a symposium I held in New York on the medical and ecological consequences of Fukushima. Download it and listen to it. I would recommend you read my books. Not that I want to make any money, but it's imperative that we understand these issues in depth, both global warming, nuclear war, nuclear power. And then you will be empowered. Then just be quiet. Don't listen to music, go out in nature. Listen to your soul. And then you will know. You will be directed. You will be guided about what you have to do. No one ever tells me what to do. I just know. If I try and follow someone else, it never works. You know within yourself if you love this planet, if you love your children, if you love a rose, if you love anything, you will know what you have to do. That's my message to you, and it's within you. We must save this extraordinary planet and possibly the only life in the universe. That's our mandate, that's why we were born.
One of the things that makes me admire you so much is that it has been so apparent throughout the walk of your life that you have listened to your own voice and your own drummer, and you have kept on with it. Dr. Helen Caldicott, thank you so much for joining us on the Lifeboat Hour tonight. We will be in touch. Please keep speaking out. We'll look forward to putting up whatever you say on Facebook and spreading it around.
Thank you very much.
Good night. And
good
everybody
night.
Else out there on the Lifeboat Hour, I learned tonight, and I was wrong on a couple things, but that's good. That's what I do when I check and I ask the people who know and I learn and we get a clearer picture. It's not a pretty one. But we will be back with you next week. Keep your eyes open here on the Lifeboat Hour. It's Mike Rupert, Tracker of Truth, out.